You're listening to the Law of Attraction Radio Network.
Join the One Heart Song Global Prayer Network to focus on world harmony and happiness at 7:30 p.m. wherever you are in the world for just 1 hour. We know each person and your individuality makes a greater impact. It can only change when we make it our intent. You are critical to that outcome. You count. Our focus is global harmony and happiness. We invite you to gather with the collective consciousness of like-minded individuals and begin your focus at 7:30 p.m. sharp in all time zones on the new moon. For more information, please visit our Facebook page at One Heart Song Global Prayer Network. Or you can come to our website at oneheartsongglobalprayernetwork.com. You count and can make the difference. Research shows meditation has always made a better outcome, and we can have peace and lift all suffering today, now, and your participation is the critical balance. Yes, you. You are the one. Join the thousands that are already doing it. Thought is energy, and focusing it to a greater effect is making it a reality. Please join us once again at One Heart Song Global Prayer Network.com.
Welcome to Quantum Leap Book Club. During the next hour, beloved mind scientist Parisha and her guests from around the world will read and discuss various best-selling books with well-known authors. Every show will apply retention techniques designed to help you to absorb powerful knowledge to effectively change your life. Join us every week for a thought-provoking hour and re-listen as often as you can. You will be delighted by what you learn, and you will be excited by the results. Are you ready to take the quantum leap? Here's Parisha.
Welcome to the Law of Attraction Network Radio's Quantum Leap Book Club. Our host Parisha is traveling today, but we'll be joined by co-host Trina Cooper, lifelong entrepreneur, Rosemary Heyer, English teacher working with children, Joyce Mullenhauer, doctor of naturopathy, and myself, Marianne Love, psychologist. And we're reading Being Peace by Thich Nhat Hanh. And this has been a wonderful book so far, and today we're going into Chapter 5, Working with Peace. And our co-host, Trina Cooper, will take it away.
Good evening, everybody. This is Trina Cooper from Denver, Colorado. And this chapter that we're beginning today, which is on page 65 in my book, Being Peace, is entitled Working for Peace. And what's been really wonderful is that Thich Nhat Hanh, the author, is really giving us some ideas and practices that really open us up and make us think, and this chapter is definitely makes us think. So he starts out, Thich Nhat Hanh starts out talking about after the Vietnam War. He was at that point in time living in Plum Village, which was a meditation center in France after he had been exiled from Vietnam. There, he said, they received hundreds of letters every week from the Vietnamese refugee camps. And they were in Singapore and Malaysia, Indonesia. Many of the people at that time were fleeing, and they were known as boat people. He said it was very painful to read these letters because there was so much suffering that was going on with all these refugees. And while they tried to help as best they could, sometimes it was just completely discouraging from the things that they were hearing in these letters. There were a lot of young girls, especially that were raped by sea pirates. And even though the United Nations had been trying, along with other countries, to try and help the government of Thailand prevent the piracy, these sea pirates were just everywhere, and they were just inflicting so much suffering on the refugees. So he points out that one day they received a letter telling them about a girl who was 12 years old, who was raped by a Thai pirate. She was so upset, she actually jumped into the ocean and drowned herself. Now, a lot of the boat people that fled from Vietnam died in the ocean, but in this case, she literally threw herself into the ocean because she was so upset. When you first hear about something like this, you can get very angry at the pirates. You can get very upset about it. He said, but we have to really take a look at this. We have to look at this a little bit differently, because if you come at it from the perspective of the pirate, he said, especially do it in meditation, that if you were born in the village that the pirate was born in, and you lived under the conditions that the pirate lived in, and you were raised the way he was raised, then you could very possibly be a pirate too. And that's what he said. I would now be the pirate. He said there was a great likelihood that he could be a pirate. And so he can't condemn himself as easily that way. So he can't condemn the pirate with anger like he had before. And in his meditation, he said he saw many babies born along the Gulf of Siam. There were, if there were educators or social workers or politicians that could do something about the situation, then maybe we wouldn't have it. And now, at this time, there were hundreds every day being born. And how many of them would actually become sea pirates because of the conditions and programming that they have as they grow up? So he said, if you take a gun and shoot the pirate, you shoot all of us. It's just that some of us have been raised a bit differently, but we could all be responsible. And this is the point he's trying to make, is that all of us are responsible to some extent for this state of affairs, for the problems that were happening there, and the conditions that were causing people to turn into the sea pirates. He said, after a long meditation, on page 166, he wrote a poem. And he said, in there's three people, that 12-year-old girl, the pirate, and himself. And he said, can we look at each other and recognize ourselves in each other? So the poem is called, and please call me by my true names. And he said, when I hear these names, I have to say yes. And I'm going to read the poem because it's so beautiful. So please call me by my true names. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow. Even today, I'm still arriving. Look deeply. Every second I am arriving. To be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with still fragile wings, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I am a mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I'm the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I'm a frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond, and I am the grass snake that silently feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I'm a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hands, and I'm the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom all over the earth. My pain is like a river of tears, so vast it fills the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all my cries and laughter at once, so I can see that my joy and pain are one. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up, and the door of my heart can be left open the door of compassion. And I do believe in reading this poem and listening to the scenario that brought it through, this poem through in meditation. He's really inviting us to open ourselves up to the different perspectives and to realize that our situations, our programming, things in our lives have created who we are, and we need to have compassion for everyone and everything, because the way they live and the way they express themselves definitely is a result of the situations around them. And through that compassion, we can heal. So with that, I'm going to pass it to the next co-host who is going to pick it up from there.
Thank you. This is Rosemary from Frankfurt, Germany. Hello, Trina and everyone. I'm Pat going on and on page 68. And he's sharing a Zen story, and that is that a man is riding a horse that is galloping very fast, and another man is standing and saying, "Where are you going?" And the man on the horse says, "I don't know. Ask the horse." So, and he's saying that this is the situation we are in today, and even though the book was written in 1987, there's so much things which are actually the same. So he's saying this is the situation we have today we cannot control. We are riding many horses, and we cannot control them. And one of the horses is the many weapons we focus on and we have. And he's saying that our lives are so busy, we are not able to control all the horses we are running. However, in Buddhism, the most important thing to do, the most important practice, is to live in awareness, to know what is going on at all times. And so to know what is going on, and when you're really busy and running many horses, that is very difficult. So he's sharing some examples, and we're on page 69 now. He's sharing some examples like how far actually this awareness goes, the Buddhism is asking us to do. For example, when you eat a piece of bread, you may choose to be aware of the farmers and the growing of the wheat and the chemical poisons which has been used to get it growing, and that we are actually co-responsible for the destruction of our environment. And he also says that we can increase our awareness of the hunger which is still existing for many, many children. And in that time, he's saying that every day 40,000 children died of hunger. And also regarding to how meat are produced or how liquor is produced, where we use a lot of grain. And he's also sharing the example of eating a bowl of rice and how that could be more reconciling of the suffering of Mother Earth and the world, because instead of eating a piece of meat. And he's also saying that in there's an authority in France who said that if we are stopping to eat meat, if 50% of the world population would stop eating meat and drinking alcohol, that would be already enough to change completely the situation of the environment and of the whole world. Only 50% less he's focusing on. So he says that everything we are doing is things which have to do with the peace in our world. And we need to be aware of our lifestyle, our way of consuming, of looking at things. And he says, he reminds us again that to print such a paper, a whole forest may be needed. And if we are aware of what is going on when we have a piece of paper in hand, that the whole forest is needed and all the things which go in there to produce it, if we are aware of everything around us, we actually then can do something to change the course of things. And that is actually active Buddhism. And he's, I think that it's amazing what he's sharing here is really so up to date if you think about the discussion regarding climate change. And already in 1987, this monk shared what we're talking about today so much that everyone can do something in their everyday life by being aware of how they work their lifestyle, how they deal with their garbage, and so on. But it's going much more beyond that. The awareness he's asking us to do, and that is quite to be quite open and to be focused why we are doing, and not to be too busy, to running too many horses. It's really to go beyond eating the bread and saying thank you, but really realizing what it does to the environment, the kind of bread we are eating, or what it does, who is involved in producing the bread. So really compassion to everything and being aware, that is the most important thing in Buddhism. And I'm passing on now to the other host, Joyce.
Hi, this is Joyce in Kingman, Arizona. And he picks up here about the awareness, speaking of gathas, G-A-T-H-A. This is not something that I'd ever seen this word. So the dictionary says that a gatha is a short verse to help us practice mindfulness in our daily activities. So he talks about the fact that when he learned to ride a bicycle, he was the very first monk to ride a bicycle in his temple. And at that time, there was no gatha about riding a bicycle. So as time went on, he wrote a gatha about starting a car. And he talks about when you start your car, you need to know where you're going. And he elaborates on saying that there are times in many of our lives where if we happen to have a car, that we think we want to get away from ourselves. So we climb into our car to drive somewhere. But we haven't asked ourselves, why are we driving? And quite recently, from another discussion, we talked about asking ourselves all day long, why are we doing a particular activity? Well, if you're trying to get away from yourself, you're still right along for the ride. So going in the car probably will not change anything for you. But if you take a walking meditation as an example, you might have a whole different concept of why you were trying to get away from yourself in the first place. So asking yourself why and where shall I go, you're not going to be like the rider on the horse that says, well, the horse knows where it's going, but you're kind of admitting you don't know yourself where you're going. So he goes on further here to talk about non-duality, and I think we've all discussed a lot about duality and that being kind of part of our existence, that there's two sides to everything, opposite sides. Non-duality is actually the human experience of oneness with all things, so that there isn't any difference between yourself, myself, and what we're experiencing and everything in our surroundings. So with a car, we become the car. With a gun, we become dangerous. And with a flute, we become something very pleasant, adding to the environment where we are. With 50,000 atomic bombs now existing in our world, humankind has become the most dangerous species on Earth. And I found that such a revealing statement for myself, because I don't think I ever have really embraced that all those atomic bombs are there because of me as well as because of many other factors, because we're all one, and we've had an influence on that big time. So we also have an influence on where the atomic bombs end up. But in the meantime, as a planet, as a population, we have never been more dangerous, is how he is trying to bring our awareness. So he speaks of the most basic precept is to be aware, and that's where Rosemary ended her discussion too. Not only aware of our own feelings and body experiences, but to be aware of what we do, what we are. And this isn't just something you think about once or twice a day or at church on Sunday or whatever. You think about this every minute. So then by thinking of that, then your actions follow. By being aware, we can make a difference. So looking deeply into things in order to see, and his whole interpretation of seeing is not, this isn't something that we're experiencing through our eyes. This is something that we're becoming one with the experience. So if we're swimming in the river, and we have that absolute privilege to do so in a beautiful river, we are the river. And he gives the example of when he was out of his own area in Boston, just outside Boston, at the Boston University, and he was looking at the river called the Charles River. And because he loved and was so interactive with rivers, he decided he wanted to go down and wash his face and put his feet in the water, which he did. And when he returned to the group, a professor said, "That is the most dangerous thing you could do. Did you rinse your mouth in the river?" And when I told him yes, he said, "You should see a doctor and get a shot." Well, this was the biggest shock to our author, because he did not associate rivers as being dead rivers or poisonous rivers. And again, when he related to the fact that the river was part of him and he was part of the river and it was a oneness there, then he realized more and more that here was another example of something that had developed because of the oneness of the universe and because we had allowed it to happen. So if you're a mountain climber and you like to be in the forests are our lungs outside of our bodies. And knowing that the forests produce oxygen for us and we produce carbon dioxide for them, of course we're very, very connected. But if we allow ourselves to be imprisoned, and this is something that really, again, impacted me because I did not sort of think through this ever until I read this statement. We are imprisoned, he tells us, in our small self, thinking only of the comfortable conditions for this small self while we destroy our large self. So I realized reading that I had not taken any sense of responsibility that I had had something to do with feeling like I was imprisoned in my small self. But this was very much an understanding or an awareness that I had not allowed myself to realize that the large self I am is what that water is what that forest is. And he also uses the example of the sun and how one day he became very aware and saw that the sun was his heart. So the sun is my heart. And the sun is my heart outside of the body. So if the heart inside my body dies, I can no longer exist. If the sun dies, I can no longer exist. I cannot function. So these are very much the same concept that we, if we're going to be true to ourself and understand that ourself is a part or is the forest, is the water, then we can start having a larger understanding and a hope for the future. And this non-dualistic way of seeing that is universal oneness and such a powerful, powerful sense of connectedness will be part of our daily life and our daily breath. And that's when we move now to Marianne Love.
Wonderful, Joyce. That was beautifully described. Thank you. And so he takes us on here to the story about the Vietnam War. And a really amazing example of how you actually become and see the world with awareness in a non-dualistic way, even when your lives are on the line. And they did this during the war. Many of the young Buddhists actually died. And they didn't just die because of the bombs and the war, but they were actually killed because they were suspected of being on the other side. So the communists killed them because they thought they were anti-communists and working with the Americans, and the anti-communists killed them because they thought they were communists. And so this happened because they were simply wanting peace and they were practicing non-duality and they wanted to simply understand both sides. And in understanding both sides, they shared that understanding, and this was misunderstood by those who were involved in the war. And so they just wanted the fighting to stop. And he said, I thought this was really cute. He said, the bombs were so loud, and I totally can empathize with that. And sometimes they even went to extremes, like burning themselves alive just to get their message out. And even this was misunderstood as a political act. But he said they did it because they wanted action to their actions to be heard. They just simply wanted to be understood. And they wanted reconciliation. And they didn't want victory. Killing is not victory, but they wanted peace. And so it was very, very dangerous for them to do this. And so, and because they can be so misunderstood, so he shares on the following page. In my book, it's page 70, but everybody seems to have different books. So hopefully any one of your listeners is identifying with one of our pages. But I'm on page 70, and he says here that reconciliation is to be understood by both sides. To go to one side and describe the suffering being endured by the other side, and then go to the other side and describe the suffering being endured by the first side. Doing only that will be a great help for peace. And he shares some examples about how he's instructed some of his students to achieve this. And so one way he shares a story about one of his students, and he asked them to express himself as a swimmer in a river. And then after some breathing practice for about 15 minutes, he asked the student to express himself as the river, to become the river, to feel the river, to express the language of the river. And again, he asked another woman who had been in the Soviet Union to express herself as an American. And after doing breathing and meditation, this Soviet citizen, with all her fears and hopes for peace, did a wonderful job of expressing herself as an American. These are practices, these are exercises of non-duality. He shared a poem with us that he wrote for his fellow Buddhists, and it was written to help them come to terms with and to let go of hatred about all the deaths that occurred. And how to embrace death non-violently. And it's called Recommendation. Promise me this day, while the sun is just overhead, even as they strike you down with the mountain of hate and violence, remember, brother, man is not our enemy. Just your pity, just your hate, invincible, limitless, hatred will never let you face the beast in man. And one day, when you face this beast alone, your courage intact, your eyes kind, out of your smile will bloom a flower, and those who love you will behold you across 10,000 worlds of birth and dying. Alone again, I'll go on with bent head, but knowing the immortality of love. And on the long, rough road, both sun and moon will shine, lighting my way. So to practice meditation is to be aware of the existence of suffering. And so this takes us now to the next section where we'll have Trina share.
Thank you, Marianne. Thank you so much. I love his poetry. It's so beautiful, but it still has a point and it makes you think. The next section, Thich Nhat Hanh moves on, and he says to us, and I think he's speaking to those in the U.S. at this point in time when he's written the book, that you may not be aware that your country's been manufacturing a lot of conventional weapons that go to other countries and are used to kill its people. He said, you know very well in your heart that the children and the adults in all of these countries really need food and housing, and they have needs that they have, not the deadly weapons. But he says it's funny because no one has time to organize, to fight this, to take a look at it, to debate it, to take a look at it, and to stop this from happening, the stopping the sales. Everybody is just way too busy. these conventional weapons have been doing so much killing, and we even see that, you know, in our countries around the world, especially with the threats of terrorism and things like that nowadays. He said, when we don't pay attention to this, we commit some kind of error, because we are part of this. He says, I believe former President Reagan said that the U.S. has to continue to make conventional weapons to sell, because if you don't, someone else will, and the U.S. will lose its interest. And here in this place, he really makes a statement about how he feels, in that he says, this statement is off course. It's an excuse, but that there are deeper factors that are actually driving this. And one example he gives is that a lot of people will lose their jobs when they work in factories that create weapons, and what kind of work could possibly help these people if that industry stops. So he's taking us a step into thinking outside the box, that things don't have to be exactly the same way as what we see them happening, but we have to come up with solutions to provide these people with another way of making money if they aren't working in those jobs. So he says there aren't a lot of Americans that are aware of the fact that these weapons in these places are killing people every day, and that Congress doesn't even debate this issue. He said, we as a whole haven't taken much time to take a look at this clearly. We haven't been able to change our government policies. We aren't strong enough to pressure the government. We have to remember that the government is largely dictated by its people and the way of life that they hold. So we have a responsibility as citizens to do something about this. There are ways that we can make an impact, because if the government's free to make a policy, but that policy completely depends on the way we live our lives. And he said right now, it's not possible at this time. He said some people think they can run for government and they can make an impact. But we see this very often, and he points this out, that some of the most well-meaning people that get into office end up doing kind of the same thing, just a little better, maybe a little bit worse, but they get pressured by the system and what's going on around them to conform even more than what they thought they would. So we really have to take a look at it. He's kind of challenging us to take a look at the real situation. We have to look at how we live, how we drink, how we eat, how everything we do impacts the world situation. And he's asking us to meditate, to see into these things more deeply. How can we change these? How can we create a transformation in all of these situations? And he says the way we do this is by transforming our mind. Because if we change our mind, the way we think, we change the way we act, the way we are. He makes the statement that the situation is mind and the mind is situation. So awakening is a very, very important part of this. So we need to look at the nature of the bombs, the natures of injustice, the nature of weapons, and the nature of our own being, that they're all the same. So we have to go inside and take a look at it. And he says, this is the real meaning of engaged Buddhism. And with that, I will hand it off to co-host Rosemarie.
Thank you, Trina. And we are now on page 77, and he's sharing something different now, and that is seven practices of reconciliation, which have been evolved in the Buddhist monasteries and are used since about 2,500 years. And they were actually formulated to settle disputes between the monks if there were conflicts, but he thinks that they can also be used in our households, in our personal life, and in our society. So he's sharing these practices now, and the first practice is a face-to-face sitting. And in a Buddhist way, that would actually be sitting together face-to-face, mindfully breathing and smiling, with a willingness to help and not with a willingness to fight. And that would also especially happen in the presence of the whole Sangha, the whole community. And they all would be present and listen to this and support this. So everyone in the community would expect that they would make peace. And he also shares an important detail, which I think is really great, because he says that everyone in the community has refrained from gossiping about the situation or spreading any gossip about the conflict of the two monks. And the second practice is remembrance. And here the monks are sharing little details they had in the conflict. And for example, he's giving an example like, I remember that that day it was rainy and I went to the kitchen and you were there. So, and this is that the whole Sangha becomes aware of what is going on, and that everyone is exactly aware of what happened in details, and it is spoken so that it cannot explode and it will be too late. And he says that to recall the details from the past is the only thing to do now. So that is actually a start to get into it without being in an angry way. And he's referring also to a conflict between men and women who often have maybe some negative situations, but they don't talk about it, and then things explode. So again, it is to be aware of what is going on in ourselves and our feelings in our bodies and in our surroundings. And he's saying that this is very important in our life. We're coming to the third principle, that is non-stubbornness. And he's saying here that everyone involved, the monks especially, the two monks who have the conflict, need to really to do their best for reconciliation. Yeah, that is very important, that they show that they put their best foot forward and really working hard on coming to an understanding and accepting. Number four is, the fourth practice is called covering mud with straw. And he's referring to the idea that when there's a muddy ground, that you can actually walk on it when you put straw over it. And this is done by two senior monks of the community. And each senior monk represents one side of the conflict or one side of the other monk. And they are actually sharing their sides. And that is helping to de-escalate the feelings with the concerned conflict of the people. So that is very important, to allow some senior monks who have the respect of the community and the wisdom to share both sides, to have both sides present by a neutral person. Number five, we are now on page 80, is called voluntary confession. That is the fifth stage. And here you need to start to reveal a minor weakness. And he says that it is really an art to do this. So you would actually make yourself more vulnerable by sharing something about yourself. For example, you could say, one that day I was not very mindful. I said such and such a thing, and that is horrible. I'm sorry. So, and it's important that it's a minor weakness, because it opens up the other person, and it encourages also the other person to say a minor detail. And he's making an important point at the end. He says, imagine the Soviet Union and the United States trying to slowly de-escalate by working on small things. And I can say we can put that on other conflicts today, like the Iran conflict right now, and or the conflict with terrorism. If we start with small things to get into a atmosphere of speaking with each other. Also, he's saying that the presence of the community is very encouraging. Everyone is focusing on peace. Everyone is focusing on de-escalation. And so slowly, what he calls the Buddha nature of each person who is involved in the conflict can come out. He's coming now to stage 6 and 7 of this practice, and that is called decision by consensus and accepting the verdict. So the monks actually have agreed in advance to the community that they would accept any decision or any verdict which the community will make at the end. So they would not say, no, this is too much or too hard or so. They have agreed on that. They cannot comment or refuse it. So the community then makes a decision, and the head of the community announces that decision three times. He's actually going to the community and he reads the decision and he says, does the assembly of monks accept this verdict? And if there is a silence, it means that it is accepted. And the committee has decided on a verdict, so he's going again two times asking the same question. And this is the end of the session, and as the monks have agreed to accept any verdict, it is then put into practice. And he's saying that these kind of processes have been adopted in many Buddhist monasteries in India, in China, in Vietnam, in Japan, in Korea, and many other countries for over 2,500 years. And he is recommending that this may be something we can learn also from in our personal life or in society. And I am passing now on to Joyce.
Yes, I would like to just follow that with, in the United States, the history of the Cherokee Council uses all of those practices. And it's just, we have that base at the bottom of our whole, the Constitution of the United States. So we can tap back into that because it does exist. So the peace movement that does happen or is being experienced tends to have anger, frustration, and misunderstanding with it. That people and groups that are not happy will write protest letters. But for the most part, a love letter is not something that has been mastered. So if we want Congress or the President of the United States to read and change anything that's been done, we need to be able to write a letter that they're not going to just throw away because, again, it's a negative letter that isn't giving any solutions. We want to be able to write it in a way that not, doesn't turn them off or doesn't turn whoever is seeing those letters first. If we recognize the president is a person just like us, so we want to be able to support and encourage and offer some solutions. And everything that he's saying in here is definitely representing some of those solutions. So some of what he has written here on page 82, I think is worth reading almost daily. And I'm going to read what he has put into this book. Can the peace movement talk in loving speech, showing the way for peace? This is our challenge for sure. This will depend on whether the people in the peace movement can be peace. Can we smile? Or if we cannot smile, we cannot help other people smile. If we're not peaceful in ourselves, then how can we contribute to the peace movement? And the author says he hopes we can bring a new dimension to the peace movement, not filled with anger and hatred, but a fresh way of being peace, of doing peace. So that those two phrases, being peace and doing peace, if we confront ourselves individually and ask, what have I done today that has been an example of either being peace or doing peace, or if something went on today that I now recognize I could do differently, then we can put that to get to work on the next day of our life. So it is important, and he's certainly offered meditation as a means to be able to look, see, and understand. And it would be wonderful, he says, if we could bring to the peace movement our contribution, that's our personal contribution, our way of looking at things, to diminish aggression and hatred. Peace work means, first of all, being peace. And he has stressed that over and over again in this book. Meditation is meditation for all of us. We rely on each other. And this final statement, our children are relying on us in order for them to have a future. So that is how this chapter ends, and it's pretty powerful.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Joyce. That was great. So now some time for sharing. So I invite any of the co-hosts who would like to share at the moment. Is there something that's inspired you about this chapter?
Hi, this is Trina in Denver. This particular chapter for me really strikes home because not only in being an entrepreneur, but in working in business with everyone, but I've also been quite active in politics and social movements more so than politics in coming forward with solutions instead of fighting against, being for something or looking for a win-win. And just some of the wording in this particular chapter and the way he looks at things, taking the perspective even deeper, this to me is, it reminded me of some things that Parisha has shared about confronting. But confronting doesn't mean taking a hard position. It means coming front and putting it on the table so that it first off can be brought into awareness and be put in front of us, and then it can be worked on to come and come to a solution and a resolution that works for everyone. So this idea of coming together, and instead of looking for a fight or expecting to step into a fight for something, but instead looking for solutions, looking for peaceful resolution, looking for something that's going to raise the living situations for everyone. The one thing is, when we do that and we address things this way, especially when we come from the perspective of all parties, we can find that. And it's important for us to understand the perspective of all parties. Just like I know in Denver here, there's a lot of people who live on the street. Some of them actually get insulted when you try and find them a home, or you try and find them shelter, or you try and get them food and things, because they've chosen the lifestyle that they have. They like the freedom of what they're doing. Sitting and talking to them and asking them questions, you know, they didn't like the life they had. Now, there are people who are on the street who really, really can use help, but there's some people who are on the street who have chosen that as their lifestyle. And so for us to think that we have to do something to fix it for them, isn't necessarily the right way to go. So this chapter talks a lot about all those potentials, all the ways of looking at situations, and the different way to bring things forward, put them on the table, and find a win-win and a great solution for everyone. So that's what I wanted to share.
Beautiful. Thank you. Powerful. Is there anyone else who'd like to share?
Yeah, this is Rosemary. I would love to share. There's so much I could say, and I agree with Trina. This is really so important nowadays, too. I'm thinking about the Iranian situation. I'm thinking about all the demonstrations about climate change, where we are still bashing certain companies, or we even bashing the farmers, and that is not, it's not about that. It's always to be the awareness of the whole. And I think in this page there's two steps. One is that he's asking us to have a greater awareness of what is going on. And it has really been impressing for me that how much one needs to be really aware to be so present to what he is saying. I mean, it takes a lot of open heart and a lot of being present in the moment. I was actually working on that while I was reading the book, and I noticed that you really have to be open-hearted and have to be completely in understanding to really be aware of what is going on in the greater picture to every side. And I just actually tried that in practice, that being, that understanding what he's talking about in the beginning, becoming one with the other. And I remember in chapter 3, he said, you just look and you allow yourself to be, and then you lose yourself in it. And I just noticed that I had a lot of previous fears and feelings and mixed up emotions about a situation. There was a situation where an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old boys raped a 16-year-old girl in Germany. That was recently. And I remember that I was always, this thought comes to my mind, and it's about the same what he was sharing in the beginning, is how much have they been beating these people? How much have these people been beaten that they are that cruel? That is actually a saying from Bertolt Brecht, a very famous German writer. And that came to me when I read that in the newspaper. But still, to really be one with the other side, with the rapist, to be one with the cruelty of the other person, that is really a wonderful thing to do, and I can see how challenging it can be. There was two things I really liked also when he said in one of the poems, remember, man is not our enemy. And I would, and I'm thinking about this whole chapter, how can I pass this chapter on into my life? And also, how can I pass this information of how we can do reconciliation and how we can deal with the conflict in the world? How can I pass that on into the society? It seems to be such a strange concept if you think about how we deal with conflict today. So I really feel inspired to find ways to share this and also to share the practices regarding solving a conflict. So that's it for right now. There's much more I could say, but this is it for right now.
Excellent, Rosemary. Thank you for that. Is there anyone else that would like to share? We've got about 6 minutes now.
This is Joyce. I would like to share just two quick points. One is a patient that I have right now who's totally obsessed with the fact that the days that he feels bad, that there's so much in the air that he's breathing, that he is a victim. And this man cannot let that go. He is obsessed with it almost day in and day out. So somehow he thinks if the whole world knew that he was suffering with this, that somebody would take action. But he sure is feeding the negative side of it. The other point I wanted to make is in my own life journey, I am more and more recognizing that if I put into just very simple words what my greatest yearning is I want to feel totally connected. And I get really emotional about it when I deeply look at what I think that means. And something in this chapter helped me realize that I have, up until reading this particular chapter, that goal of feeling totally connected somehow seemed like a very distant goal. And yet in my heart, and he speaks of the heart being a sun, and this is our source, the truth is I'm already there. I'm already connected. I just have to allow that. So I can see where I can go with this from this day is asking myself many, many times in the day, why am I doing each activity so that I know that there is a connection there with what I choose to do? So that is where I'm at with this chapter.
Yeah, powerful, Joyce. Thank you for sharing that. And it's also opened me up to quite a few ideas. And I really get in all of this that it's mainly about understanding, not taking position and not necessarily agreeing or disagreeing. And I know in my life when I've played a bit of devil's advocate in a way that I've just shared the other side, or I like to see from all sides. I'm a therapist. Like, I do that all day. Like, I enjoy understanding. But sometimes that's misunderstood as disagreeing or agreeing or taking sides in itself. And I also realized that there are times inadvertently I do take sides, and it made me aware of one of the times I've done that recently. And I've been reacting when people take sides. Like, so I've been reacting when, say, somebody says something about men or something about a particular race or it's more obvious to me when they say it about men when they're a woman, because I think sometimes in our culture there are certain biases that are socially acceptable and that people will, as a community, agree with. And I realise I've started to take issue with the people, like with women, that say negative things about men and sort of blame men. And I realised just in doing that that I was actually taking a position as well and not seeking compassion for what I was seeing too. So I had to chuckle a little bit at myself at that. It's a tricky mind games, I think. So just being aware of seeking compassion and seeking understanding for everyone, including myself, I think is a powerful take-home of all of this. And I know some of it, what he shares, is what we've done in psychology, which is psychodrama or empty chair work people might be familiar with. And Parisher has taught theatre of the mind, which is a Cherokee way of doing the same thing, but actually acting out either each of the roles or even journaling out each of the roles is a really powerful way of stepping into other people's shoes. And the only other thing I thought was really valuable to share that compassion for self is also a big part of this, and when we judge ourselves, we're also in the position of taking sides, just sides against ourselves, and that's as harmful and damaging as taking sides against anything. That's what I wanted to share. So we've got a couple of minutes. Is there anything anybody else wanted to put in?
This is Trina in Denver again. As you were speaking, Marianne, it was making me think about some of the things that Parisher would say sometimes, that there's no right, there's no wrong, it just is. And this chapter, to me, really kind of exemplified that, in that sometimes we can't make things right and we can't make things wrong. We just have to look at them and just say, this is what it is. Is it something that I want? Is it something that I resonate with? Or is it something that someone else wants or that they resonate with? And then we work to build what works for ourselves, or we work to build what works for them. But, you know, we all have all been born with certain rights of life, and we hear it in the U.S. in some of the Constitution and things, you know, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, health, wealth, and happiness, those things. And when we work toward those and we work toward a win-win, we take that what is and we turn it into something that can be absolutely beautiful. So it doesn't have to be done in a confrontational state, in a fight all the time. It can be done when it's brought to the table properly, in really working on compromise and resolution with positive solutions for everyone. So I just think it's beautiful when we can keep ourselves in that state of mind.
Absolutely. Parisher always says, be what you're for. So it's time to conclude our studies for today, and we thank you for sharing your time and your energy with us. You matter and count, and you always make a difference. We look forward to being with you again next week as we leap to greater consciousness. Have a powerful week, allow your light to shine, and always all good things to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Quantum Leap Book Club. For more information where you can contact us, go to loaradionetwork.com/quantum-leap. Have a great week.